This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello, welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, a local musician remembers a country music icon. CBU professors talk about the Canada-U.S. tariff war. The medical school at CBU has officially opened. The Glace Bay Food Bank shelves are getting empty. Escazoni is bouncing back from a flash flood. The curtains open on a Cape Breton Film Festival. And hats off to the Highland Arts Theatre for giving singing lessons. These stories are coming up on the Coast 89.7. The Glace Bay Food Bank is having trouble keeping food on the shelves. Director Linda McCrae says she can hardly remember when they were in a situation quite like this.
I've been here for 5 years, and I can honestly say that I can see a very critical situation starting to happen, and it's going to continue. Our numbers are rising. People are not doing well, and they have to access the food banks. So it's very worrisome.
McCrae says they have more clients now because of the rising food prices, while donations are down because generous people are also struggling.
Oh, donations have been at their lowest ever. Yes, like I said, in the 5 years I've been here, I've never seen donations so low, and I understand with the cost of living for everybody, it's hard for people now to donate because they're also worried about their own living situation and the cost that they have to pay. But there's such a large group. I'm in the middle of a perfect storm right now. Our numbers are going up. People in need are increasing, and donations are at their lowest.
Normally, the food bank is lacking items like canned milk and nutritious food, but McCrae says their inventory is down across the board.
And I don't mean to sound greedy, but we can use all non-perishables of every sort. Soups, peanut butter, cereal, spaghetti sauce, just to name a few. We will turn nothing away because it's all needed. I went to the grocery store last week and spent $6,000 to fill our shelves. They're almost empty again, and there's nothing coming in to replenish. And there's no way I can spend that amount of money every week to keep our families fed.
McCrae is encouraging anyone who can give across the Cape Breton Regional Municipality to check in with their local food bank because they are all dealing with the same challenges. Experts on political science and economics teaching in Cape Breton are sharing their thoughts on the renewed and escalating trade war between Canada and the U.S. The Coast 89.7's Jacob Hostelwaite reports.
Last weekend, trade negotiations between the two countries broke down, with Prime Minister Mark Carney saying they were due to last-minute changes from the Americans that would have hampered Canada's ability to make independent trade deals and suppression of Canada's French language. In response, Canada announced a plan to retaliate dollar for dollar with incoming U.S. tariffs. On Tuesday, the government announced $7.5 billion in tariff relief funds and $27.6 billion in tariffs against the U.S. Now, two Cape Breton University professors are sharing their thoughts on Canada's response to the tariff war and the relationship between Canada and the United States. Dr. Tom Urbaniak is a professor of political science at CBU and feels the response from Canada is measured.
It is a mirror response as well, because in many cases, in most cases, Canada is imposing tariffs on the same kinds of goods on which the United States has imposed tariffs. And Canada is using the very logical argument that part of the reason for these tariffs in those same sectors is to protect Canadian producers and Canadian workers so that they are not at a competitive disadvantage. So you can imagine that our industries are being taxed to sell into the United States and therefore are under a burden. And then Americans are able to flood the Canadian market with the same products at a lower price. So that makes sense in respect to a response. Under the circumstances, I can only describe it as even-keeled and moderate on the part of Canada.
Meanwhile, CBU economics professor Patrick de la Miranda feels the escalating tariffs are part of the process.
You know, it's a part of the negotiation between the U.S. government and the Canadian government. It's just a way to try to convince the U.S. government to come back to the table and try to find a deal that will please both sides. But I think it's just the normal reaction of the federal government in this case.
The profs shared their feelings on the changing relationship between Canada and the U.S., which has seen the two countries who've spent decades integrating their economies now pulling back and looking for business elsewhere. Urbaniak feels the movement is uniting Canadians.
It's certainly a bi-Canadian moment, and that is the message from the top, and that's the message on the ground as well. It is a moment where we will have to support each other. This might escalate. It might escalate rhetorically. I mean, we're seeing the latest salvo from Trump about renaming Lake Ontario. And it may escalate in terms of counter tariffs. Most Americans don't even realize they're in a trade war and that this is very serious. And in a sense, that's an advantage to Canada because we are sort of all in on this. We realize that this is a crisis moment. We realize that we will have to take some pain. And as long as we organize ourselves so that we are doing it fairly among ourselves, we should be able to withstand the pain for a while. Whereas I'm not sure the Americans are prepared for pain, economic pain, for a cause that is unclear. Like, what is America trying to do? Like, why launch a trade war against Canada? Why provoke and insult your closest neighbor and best ally? It doesn't make sense to most Americans, but now Americans are living with the consequences of not taking their duties as citizens seriously and putting into office people who do not show even a basic level of maturity or professionalism. I mean, this is the consequence of superficial populism, and Americans are going to feel some pain as a result of this.
De la Miranda says it's hard to determine at this moment what Canada's relationship with the U.S. will be in the future, even after President Donald Trump leaves office.
Because an economy, it's a big boat. So when you try to move from one direction and to change the direction of that boat, it takes time. It's a long process. And right now, for many years, until now, until Trump, we were in line with the U.S. economies. So we were, both economies were very integrated. And right now, with the tariff in place on both sides, we need to look for other partners. And this takes time. So we can build our own stuff here in Canada, or we have to export somewhere else. And though this needs some time to proceed, so it's all the difficulties in the process. So do we want to wait until Trump is no more in the office and see what will be the new life after Trump, or do we want to react right now and send a signal to the economy to say, okay, let's find new partners? And in that case, the federal government is just trying to guess and try to predict what the situation will be in 2 years. So the measures that were put in place by the federal government is a way to go through the process, to send a signal to the U.S. government that, no, we're not be bullied by you, but at the same time, try to mitigate those effects in the Canadian economy.
Urbaniak says he's been surprised with the amateur and bizarre approach to negotiating the U.S. is taking.
I think Canada thought that we were genuinely close to a deal. I think even Donald Trump thought we were genuinely close to a deal. And then they start playing these games with adding new people to the negotiations. Howard Lutnick, the Commerce Secretary, went in there. They're introducing issues where no one had done the research or prepared briefing notes. They think just on the back of a napkin, they can start trying to dictate Canada's language policies, packaging, or try to give themselves the right of veto over any future trade agreements that Canada might want to enter into with any other country. So just this sort of casualness with which they walk in at the 11th hour and think, well, maybe since we've gotten some concessions from Canada, we can effectively make them our colony now and do it in the next hour. If this is what happened on Friday night. And it's remarkable to me that a major industrial power, a superpower of 350 million people, this is the best they can cough up in terms of leadership, in terms of diplomacy. I mean, there's some real soul searching that has to happen here.
De La Miranda says it's hard to determine what the right solution is to deal with the tariff issue.
It's difficult to find the right solution to this problem, because is it a short-term problem or is it a long-term problem? So this is my view about this situation, because if we just think that the current crisis is temporary because Trump has his way to do stuff, and in 2 years this situation will be completely different, then we just have to wait and to go through two different difficult years and wait, because changing the structure of the economies is costly, and we have to keep this in mind. So, but on the other hand, do we have the certainty that in 2 years the situation will be way better than what we have right now? Will we be back to the situation where the United States are our best partners and our best allies, in economically speaking and militarily speaking? This is something that I don't know for sure. Be prepared for the worst case scenario and looking for new partners is definitely something that we should do right now. But again, this kind of stuff takes time. Finding partners with European countries, the European unions, it takes time to put in place. It's not something that we can do in a few months, few weeks. It takes time.
Urbaniak feels the damage done to the relationship between Canada and the U.S. is generational.
So even if and when a friendly administration comes in the United States, there will always now be a high level of suspicion about any dealing we have with the United States and about any agreements in the future that might bring us very, very close to them economically or politically. I mean, in a way, that's the long history of Canada. We've seen serious incidents and conflicts with the United States, but this is certainly a historical moment again.
A 50% tariff from the U.S. on a number of Canadian goods is now in place, with Trump outlining plans for a 50% increase in tariffs on vehicles and steel that's set to start on January 1st. This has been coverage of the ongoing trade war between Canada and the United States, with comments from CBU professors Dr. Tom Urbaniak and Patrick de la Miranda.
The new medical campus at Cape Breton University has welcomed about 30 students. It's a partnership between Dalhousie Medical School and CBU. The campus Senior Associate Dean, Dr. Stephanie Langley, says students are being encouraged to practice in rural Nova Scotia communities when they become doctors. And she goes on to say fewer people will need a family doctor thanks to the new school.
Cape Breton Medical Campus was a huge investment by the province of Nova Scotia to really address the shortage of family physicians in rural Nova Scotia. So the whole impetus of this campus is to train, 30 family doctors to graduate, eventually 30 family doctors a year. So students are in a family medicine pathway. They've kind of like committed to doing family medicine on acceptance into the Cape Breton Medical Campus, and have committed and actually signed a contract with the government to do a five-year return of service when they're done their training to kind of work as a family physician in rural Nova Scotia. So that is pretty exciting for, you know, people out there that don't have a family doctor at the present time. This is certainly going to address that and hopefully maybe, you know, take our Need a Family Practice Registry down to zero eventually.
Langley says recruiters will work with students and encourage them to discover rural Nova Scotia as their future home and workspace.
I mean, certainly the recruitment team, Nova Scotia Health's recruitment team, is anxious to kind of like meet with our students. The interesting thing is in third year, our students will go across rural Nova Scotia and spend their third year of medical school in the communities that they may eventually choose to work in. So they will get a chance during their medical training to spend a full year in a community, understand the role of the family physician in that community, how that physician interacts with the specialty community, basically how medicine is run in that community. And the hopes would be that's a good early introduction to rural family medicine. Once they do their residency training, they may go back to that community and ultimately practice there. So it is kind of built into their undergrad curriculum to have an early introduction to, you know, rural medicine in Nova Scotia.
Fundraising plays a critical role in modern day medicine.
The development team at Cape Breton University has very strong, you know, interest in raising funds to help with medical education. So we have several bursaries available to students. As you know, the campus has a rural Indigenous pathway for Indigenous students as well as Nova Scotian Black candidates. So the development team is very much in tune with, you know, businesses and, you know, various donors towards raising money to assist with medical education, which is a very expensive endeavor on the students' part.
CBMC delivers the exact same curriculum as Dalhousie Medical School's primary campus in Halifax and St. John. The new facility at CBU cost about $60 million. There's a boom in film events happening on the island, and now there's a new film festival in Inverness at the end of September. Dialogue's Cora Pirgo speaks to photographer Ken Warner and Academy Award winner Tamara Deverill about the Unamagi Cape Breton Film Festival.
So what kind of is the genesis of this event?
Well, it all started in a conversation with somebody who's quite active in trying to promote film production in Cape Breton, who was in Inverness to do one of a few sessions he was doing in various places in Cape Breton to promote the film business, in particular for people to get involved as workers. And we had lunch, and I said something like, oh, it'd be cool if there was a film festival. And he said, oh, yeah, you should do it. And that was kind of the genesis, and there were various other twists and turns, but that's kind of how it started.
But even on the social media, it says, celebrates the best of local and international cinema that has meaningful connections to the island. What does that mean?
It's basically movies that are set here, made here, made by people from here, or for some other reason could be said to have a connection to Cape Breton. And then it also can mean in certain situations, because to be honest, there are only so many movies that fit those criteria, that it's some other kind of connection, like that might be a little more peripheral, but still makes it something that, you know, we feel is worth showing.
When you said you were talking to someone, it was kind of the genesis was just kind of through a conversation. Has film always been kind of a passion for you two?
Well, we both work in the film industry. So I've worked my entire life as a production designer and art director. And Ken has worked as a still photographer pretty much his entire career. So we're you know, we're film industry people, without a doubt.
But that being said, even if I hadn't spend many years working in the film business. Even as a child, like most people, I was definitely, kind of blown away by various movies, heavily influenced by movies, have seen countless numbers of movies. And so there's that angle, too.
I think with, this film festival, the Filmo calendar events that happen, the short film festival that's at that's part of Lumiere, what would you say kind of about this kind of boom we're seeing in interest in film in Cape Breton? Or not even interest, but I guess events. I believe the interest has kind of always been there.
I think the industry is growing a lot in Nova Scotia in general, and I'm saying this as somebody who comes from the industry in Ontario and having moved here, and I find a lot of the crew that I work with in Toronto have been imported to Nova Scotia to work. So, that has a trickle-down effect into Cape Breton for sure, and I think people like Bill Culp, who works for the Cape Breton Partnership, who's one of our organizers, they're really promoting it hard because it's a viable industry and it has great career options for young people, and I think we need those things in Cape Breton. We need to keep the young people, need to expand the industry.
Especially also, I've talked about this with a few people. I believe I spoke with Bill Culp, but also Patrick Doyle. Just a few, I believe Andy Hines. We're seeing kind of this renaissance, especially right now, of Canadian film as well. What would you kind of say about that?
Well, I just on the, when you mentioned Andy Hines, the first events that we created for this festival were two screenings of Little Lorraine as a fundraiser, which were very successful. They happened in Mabu, and we sold out two screenings on the same day of a 485-seat venue. So that movie alone shows what an appetite there is for stories that people can relate to because they're set here and they're about concerns that people here have. So there are only so many Little Lorraines. There have been other movies, I think, that have hit like that, but it suggests that there's room for more movies like that, and I think there are other movies that have been made recently that hopefully will get the same kind of response.
And Tamara, what are you seeing? Is there anything kind of within Canadian filmmaking right now that you think might be the next kind of, maybe not Little Lorraine in that sense, but kind of that I guess kind of film event?
I mean, there's a lot of great Canadian films that are coming up. I know that Andy Hines, that Ken was just talking about, wants to do another film, hopefully in Nova Scotia. Sarah Pauly is shooting a film in Toronto right now. Great Canadian directors. Michael McGowan, who's a person that I've worked with, who's coming up here, happens to be shooting in Nova Scotia, so he's going to join us, and we're going to show Still Mine, which is at the festival. And hopefully Michael will be making more movies. So there's a lot of great Canadian directors that are just young and up and coming as well. We have Ashley McKenzie in the festival. She did Werewolf. That's the 10th anniversary. We're pretty excited to present that and have her come and present it with us, and hopefully she'll make some more films. And it's a great, I think the festival is a great way to encourage existing filmmakers and up and coming filmmakers.
I think you could also add that if you're paying attention to current events, which I suspect many people are, there's never been a better time to take an interest in local stories, and there's no denying that most of the movies that Canadians have grown up watching were really made elsewhere, so that might explain some extra interest in national stories and local stories, but Canadian stories
and Indigenous stories, the story of immigrants that are here, that are coming to Cape Breton, new Canadians. There's so many stories to tell now, I think, in Canada that it's a wide open book, really. And so many writers writing great Canadian stories from which we can derive, movies and television series.
I mean, even on that note, we talked a lot about Rachel Reed in interviews about the budget cuts to the arts in Nova Scotia. What would you say kind of, I guess, going back to that concept of all of these artistic things popping up almost in spite of the budget cuts. What would you say about the kind of influence those have on the, I guess, the arts in Nova Scotia?
Well, I mean, I would say, first off, it's been devastating, and I'm the co-chair of the Inverness Centre for the Arts, the Inverness County Centre for the Arts, or ICA, I'm going to call it. it was a real blow to us, as it was to many Cape Breton arts organizations that are all non-for-profit. So, you know, nothing good comes out of cuts like that. However, people did give, reach really deeply into their pockets and give to all these organizations. It caused the organizations to band together in sort of a cultural sector team. And despite the government's efforts to, you know, quash the arts and culture, which is, in my mind, economically a really bad move because it brings tourists, and tourism is one of our big economic strongholds in Cape Breton. So you'd think they'd want to encourage that and help, you know, arts and culture bring those tourists in. So, yeah, I'm kind of talking around it, but obviously, you know, the cuts are bad, but, you know, people still want to see movies and they want to see art and they want to go to music events. And I think we're unstoppable that way. It's just, you know, volunteers are going to get burnt out and people are going to get tired, but we'll keep going despite the government. No thanks to them.
What would you say, I guess, about the schedule? I know you said kind of picks of movies that had meaningful connections to the island, but what kind of informed those choices? Like you said, maybe the meaning is a bit more esoteric, but what would you say about the choices behind the films on the schedule?
Well, some of the movies are kind of obvious. Tracy and Martina going out west. Although they go out west, they obviously are, you know, I can't call them classic because they're still, you know, very fresh, but they're an obvious choice. We are also focusing on a few older obvious choices, the films of Grant Crabtree that were made in the western side of the island quite a number of decades ago. They're sort of NFB and other producers, classics of those kind. We're also showing some other NFB movies that Kate Beaton and Alexander McLeod will be talking about in a panel. And they're two very well-known writers from Cape Breton. At the Place of Ghosts, although it's not specifically made in Cape Breton, it's a movie with Mi'kmaq themes and concerns made by a Mi'kmaq director, I believe. So those are some of the things that come to mind. Werewolf, which Tamara mentioned, is shot in Sydney. And unfortunately, the issues, the struggles of people with addictions and the lack of services in many cases that are available to them is an issue that was relevant 10 years ago when that movie was made, and it is a 10-year anniversary. And it's more relevant than ever today, not only in Sydney, but also in Inverness and in the area around Inverness.
What would you say, you know, I guess the importance of continuing to continue to have these kinds of events, despite the budget cuts, and inspiring, I guess, up and coming new Canadian filmmakers, Cape Breton filmmakers, Nova Scotian filmmakers, you know, looking at getting into the industry, but maybe think they can't due to, you know, whatever barriers. What advice, I guess, would you have for them?
You know, keep making movies, make your own movies, network with people, come to things like our small festival. Come, you know, go to different events, see films, read books, and keep trying to work on films in any way, shape, or form. I mean, that's what I always tell people who want to get in the industry. There's unions that you can approach, IATSE 667, IATSE, I'm not sure about the other, IATSE is in Nova Scotia. There's the Directors Guild of Canada, of which I'm a member. So there's all sorts of ways to get in, and I think it is a growing industry, and I think with the, you know, as Ken was mentioning, the current political climate, you know, hopefully the Canadian industry becomes even more Canadian and stronger as, you know, as an independent industry.
I would add that besides the mainstream production direction, it's never been easier to make a movie with limited, well, it's not limited technology, but it's available technology. So you really can shoot a movie on your phone, and you can shoot movies on digital SLRs. So really the main point I would say is just do it. We will be showing a film called Asleep by Windows that is a feature that was made for $28,000, which for a movie is a tiny amount. So, you know, that was a group of people who banded together and decided that was something that they were just going to do. And they did it. So the biggest hurdle is to just, I don't want to sound like an ad, but just do it.
And what would you say about the continued importance of film as a medium, especially for telling stories and Nova Scotian stories specifically?
Well, it's a great medium, and it speaks to a lot of people. And I find for us personally, those long winter nights, there's nothing like cozying down with a movie or two or a good television show. So, that's just me personally. Or a good book, but both are valid forms of entertainment and, you know, mind-expanding moments.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting to point out that despite all the different kinds of technologies that we see coming these days, and, you know, I don't want to talk about artificial intelligence, there's still this old idea of a movie that's about 90 minutes, maybe 2 hours, that tells a story that people seem to still want to see. You know, there's something about it that it just keeps on keeping on.
And can you share information about the where, when kind of the event?
Sure. It will happen for 3 days, September 25th, 26th, and 27th. All the screenings will be at the Inverness County Center for the Arts. There will be either 3 or 4 events per day. Some are panels with guests and discussions. Some are screenings. Some are a combination of both. And all the information is available on our website, which is Unamagi Cape Breton Film Festival.ca. And tickets can be purchased through there as well.
Well, I hope everybody comes to our little festival. So far, so good. And we're really enjoying bringing these films to Cape Breton.
That was Tamara Devrel and Ken Warner on the Unamagi Cape Breton Film Festival in Inverness.
Cape Breton Canso Andy Ganish, MP, rolled up his sleeves, helping a business owner in Escazone bail out after an intense rainstorm.
Progress is being made. Everything's going a little bit better. The rain hasn't stopped. Got all kinds of people trying to figure stuff out. Could use it 2 or 3 more strong hands, but good job, my son. Thank you.
About 100 homes were damaged from unexpected flooding recently, and Jaime Batiste says people are on edge because the First Nation wasn't expecting that much rain.
I mean, you never can tell when weather-related emergencies are going to happen. I'm pretty sure the last weather report had mainland Nova Scotia receiving a lot more rain, and then all of a sudden Escazone got the most rain in the area at about 140 millimeters. And so, yeah, I'd imagine there are some anxieties from people, but also just the inconsistencies when you hear these reports. You never really know where the damage is going to be.
He says extreme weather events should be expected, though, because of climate change.
I mean, the science shows that the northern communities and coastal communities are basically going to be the hardest hit in the years to come. And so that's what the science is telling us, and that's what we're expecting in the future.
Batiste is encouraging homeowners and businesses to document storm damage and pass it along to local elected officials to see what compensation is available.
Well, I mean, whatever happens, take pictures of the damage. Make sure you can see clearly what the storm had done from them. Also, any receipts. In generally, when it comes to storms like this that happen, because I've been a part of Hurricane Fiona, the Snowmageddon, what happens in emergencies, it's generally led by the provinces, and the provinces take care of the damages, and then we cover up to 90% of the damages federally. But when it happens on reserve, then we have the jurisdiction over that, and so federal government handles that. And so we have to help with the supports from the First Nations communities. We have a program that that we have people who are emergency contacts in each one of the First Nations communities that help us guide through, you know, what the damage is, what the houses are impacted, what we need to do in the future to mitigate those damages in some cases that are extreme, removing the house and putting something, I mean, putting it somewhere else. There's a lot of options, and so we've been what we do as federal government is just ensure that people know that there are supports available and that we're there for them.
Petit says he has also been in contact with Indigenous Services Canada Minister Mandy Galmasti and her department to see what support may be available for damages. A Cape Breton singer-songwriter says the music world lost one of its best. Buddy McDonald says Dolly Parton stood out from the others because of her incredible ability to connect with people through her music.
Well, she is the, to me, and realizing this more and more all the time, she's probably one of the greatest songwriters that I've ever heard. She has written so much good stuff that a lot of it is very simple stuff, but very meaningful as well, you know. And she writes about things that people understand, you know.
McDonald performed at Dollywood three times, most recently in 2016. Dollywood is a theme park in Tennessee owned by Parton, where she often meets with performers. He says they were asked to keep their distance, otherwise they could trigger Parton's unwavering kindness.
We met Dolly each time down there. You didn't have a whole lot of time because her time was pretty precious, you know. But each year she had one of her theaters on the site. It was a we were told by her people and her management, you know, he said, this is very crucial on time, you know. He said, and if you could just not start a conversation, and he said, and no, it doesn't mean that she's unfriendly, doesn't want to, he said, because if you start a conversation, she won't quit. What he told us. So it is quite an experience. It means more now, of course, when you're thinking back. But it's 3 different years down in Dollywood. So we spent like 14 or 15 weeks over the 3 years.
McDonald says there are too many gems in Parton's catalog to name a favorite song.
I was asked this the other day, and I couldn't even. And I think I've heard every one of those songs. My oldest daughter, who is mid-50s now, she grew up almost like a shrine in her bedroom, and she still is in love with Dolly Parton. I wouldn't dare say one song.
McDonald says Parton was a leader on the stage and likely could have been a strong, kind world leader.
Well, she was so true and so sincere, and she... through her dream, you know, through her dreams and her work, hard work, and her kindness, she did so much for the people of Sevierville, where she came from. You know, there's no fear that anything will ever happen in that little town, because she took care of everybody, children, older people, and if somebody said we haven't got the money to build a hospital, well, said, I'll build the hospital.
Awesome.
It was incredible, man. And it's, I wish she was one of the world leaders taking care of everybody now.
Parton passed away August 25th at the age of 80 after a brief battle with cancer. In one of her last interviews, Parton spoke about turning 80 and how it is just a number.
Everybody said, well, you're 80 years old. You're going to be 80 years old. I said, well, so what? Look at all I've done in 80 years. I just feel like I'm just getting started. I know that sounds stupid, but I think there's a lot to be said about age. If you allow yourself to get old, you will. And people say, "Why come? How come you don't seem to get old?" I say, "Because I ain't got time to get old."
Parton rose to prominence in the late 1960s through appearances on The Porter Wagoner Show. She won multiple Grammy Awards over several decades and was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame in 1999. And she was also inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. If you're looking to stepping up your game from just singing in the shower, the Highland Arts Theater may have something for you. Chris Tsujiuji is giving vocal lessons.
So what kind of got you into, especially singing, but kind of music in general?
So I started out as a choral singer. I sang in a lot of different choirs, the Nathaniel Dett Chorale, Univox, a bunch of different choirs in Toronto. I was also a paid soloist in a church choir, which is how a lot of choral singers make their living in Toronto. And then I attended Sheridan College and studied musical theater. And I trained as an actor, a singer, and a dancer. And I also played piano on the side that entire time and became a music director about 3/4 of the time. Since I graduated from theater school, I would say about 75% of what I do is music direct musicals. So that means teaching the cast all of their harmonies and their songs if there's a live band and it's not to track, rehearsing with the band independently of the cast, putting it all together. And I've been really fortunate to get to do that a bunch in Toronto and also across the country. I've worked at Theatre Calgary, the Arts Club in Vancouver, the Belfry Theatre in Victoria, BC, the Yukon Art Center, and also here on the East Coast, both at Neptune and Halifax and at the Highland Arts.
So what brings you to musical theater? Why it seems, you know, it's been a very long time interest.
I think there's something about story-song relationship that I find really activating, really moving. The fact that the character singing the song in the context of the musical believes wholeheartedly in all of the words that they're singing, and it's the storytelling is so strong in a way that is not always the case in pop music, but can also be the case in pop music as well.
What would you say, I guess, about the value of someone taking singing lessons who maybe they don't have an interest in going into musical theater? Like, it's just something they really enjoy doing and they want to be better at it for themselves.
I don't know if this is the best answer, but you don't need to take voice lessons to sing. You should sing anyway. Everyone should sing just purely for the joy of it and not because they're going to become a professional singer. Having said that, I guess if you're interested in honing your artistry in some sort of way or discovering something new about the song that you're singing, about yourself, about music, about the craft of singing, then you can uncover those things with the help of a good voice teacher or vocal coach.
Also kind of the value of taking them when you do want to do it professionally, because I think, you know, people are like, oh, I sing at home, I sing in the car, and I do it all the time on my own. But there are ways you can elevate your voice through singing lessons that you can't get on your own in a way. What would you say about that?
I agree. It's also, if you're doing a lot of singing, it's good to take voice lessons or have an outside ear in order to avoid vocal fatigue, vocal injury, nodules, nodes, vocal nodes, things of that nature.
You kind of said everybody can, should sing regardless of voice lessons or not. But do you think that anybody could get to a place where they could possibly sing professionally through voice lessons?
I think becoming a professional singer has just as much to do with the want as it has to do with the technique and the craft and all of that stuff. There are a lot of amateur singers or non-professional singers that could be professional singers if that's truly what they wanted to do and what they wanted to pursue. But it is a hard life. It's a very difficult path to choose. So I think the want needs to be there just as much as the honing of the craft itself.
And is that something, in a way, not that you can teach, because I think, you know, if someone has the hunger for it, they have it, or they don't. Is that something maybe almost unofficially you kind of talk about with people who come to you for singing lessons, just about, like, where obviously you can't, you know, be a career advisor, but, you know, if you look at what their goals are, kind of idea?
Absolutely. I think that a voice teacher, I was just talking about this with a friend this morning, that as a voice teacher, you really want to have your antenna up and anticipate the needs of the student. And sometimes you have to be more of like a coach or a drill sergeant. And other times you're almost a therapist in an unofficial sense. It really depends on the needs of the student, the needs, the musical needs of the song that they're singing.
And what do you think, kind of with all of this experience that you previously talked about, that you bring to this kind of position?
Not all voice teachers play the piano, which that doesn't make them not good voice teachers, but it's helpful when a voice teacher plays the piano, especially if they're preparing for a musical theater audition with a live accompanist. To be able to hear the accompaniment as it's written on the page. I also do musical theater coaching and pop crossover coaching. A lot of my students back in Toronto are classically trained and are having to sing more and more pop music as more and more musical theater shows are sounding more and more like popular music, taking on the sound of the music of the day, having to do things like riffing, high belting, mixed belting, all of those things. I guess expertise, that sounds a bit like the height of hubris, but I've music directed a lot of musicals. I've sung a lot of pop music. I've played a lot of pop music in wedding bands, cover bands, pop musicals, but I also have a background in classical bel canto technique as well. So I would say, well, I bring a well-rounded musicianship and a focus on the needs of the actual song to my voice lessons.
And what would you say to someone who's maybe thinking about taking voice lessons, but maybe is a little unsure, or maybe even just a bit insecure about their voice?
Just try it. You have nothing to lose.
Is there anything right now that, I guess, in musical theater, or that like is exciting you, that you want to bring into the vocal lessons?
Is there anything in musical theater right now that is exciting me? I don't know if this is specific to vocal lessons, but the thing that I am seeing in musical theater that I didn't see back when I graduated from theater school is a more diverse group of people on stage and more diverse stories being told. When I went to theater school and I studied the existing canon of musical theater work as it existed back then, it was a lot of cisgendered, hetero, white people falling in love with each other. And that's what musical theater was, and any secondary characters also were very stereotypical. They were archetypes, etc. And as more and more musicals get created, especially in the last 10 to 15 years, you're seeing a lot more three-dimensional characters. You're seeing a lot more intersectionality. I had teachers back in theater school who were saying to me, you can be fat, you can be gay, or you can be Asian, but you can't be all three and get work. That's not really the case anymore in the way that it was like back in 2010. So I find that very exciting.
And obviously you can't, you know, it's a very individualized thing. There might be like kind of grander aspects, but it's very individualized to the student. But are you able to kind of give, like if someone's just listening and just kind of sings for fun, are there little kind of advice tips you kind of lean on, or things that like are kind of more general that you could kind of say to our listeners?
say to everyone who's listening, the building block on which all singing takes place is the breath. Mm. So if you are expelling air at a consistent rate and you're breathing low and from the diaphragm, then that is the most important building block on which all singing takes place. Whether you're singing jazz, opera, rock, pop, musical theater, you need to be breathing. It's the most important thing.
And do the lessons strictly take place in person?
At the moment, yes, they mm-hmm. do.
Are you looking at doing virtual?
I do have a roster of students from back in Toronto that I see not on a weekly basis. Mm. The roster of students that I have back in Toronto who I do see online are more working professionals in the industry who are preparing for a specific audition, for a specific part. One of my students is currently going to play the narrator in a production of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat and really wants to get the style of those songs correct. She has her own voice teacher that she sees in person every week to work on the more technical aspects of that, and then I'm sort of coming in on Zoom and giving more stylistic tips. It's just online, to work on vocal technique online, because it's Zoom or FaceTime or whatever, it's a lot harder to see exactly what is going on and really hear it, like critically listen to the student over a Zoom connection or an internet connection and be able to diagnose accurately what is or is not happening. So online lessons are not as ideal, but for something like a stylistic choice or something like that, it's a little bit easier.
So can you share a bit of more information? Like, are you taking students right now? Where, like, how they can contact you, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so the voice lessons with me are being booked through the Highland Arts Theatre's website. So you can go on there and book a lesson with me. They happen every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. I believe there's 5 one-hour slots, and it's just first come, first serve. And then I'm going to see whoever starting this Saturday.
That was Chris Tsujiuchi on his vocal lessons offered through the Highland Arts Theatre.
That's all for Dialogue this week. If you have an idea for an interview on the program, send us an email to news@coastalradio.ca. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.